Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we begin a series about Supreme Court rulings. We'll begin by discussing what the Chevron ruling means for everyday life. The six conservatives on the Supreme Court have drastically weakened the power of federal agencies like the EPA and the FTC by overturning the 40-year-old Chevron doctrine. This doctrine stems from a unanimous Supreme Court case involving the oil giant Chevron in a dispute over the Clean Air Act, which ensured that federal agency experts, not judges, made policy decisions. Public Citizen says the 40-year-old law respects the separation of powers and ensures that agency experts make very important policy decisions. For example, Congress instructed the Food and Drug Administration to approve new medical devices shown to have reasonable assurance of safety and effectiveness, leaving it to the medical and scientific experts at the agency to determine what types of studies and evidence provide that assurance. The same is true for laws that Congress passes to protect workers, the environment, public health and safety, and other issues of importance. Public Citizen says gutting the Chevron doctrine will make it harder for federal agencies to carry out their congressionally mandated missions to protect the public. Joining us is Amit Narang, regulatory consultant for Public Citizen, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization that champions the public interest in the halls of power. Hi, Amit. Thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to join you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Food and Water Watch says the decision is a gift to corporate polluters that seek to dismantle common sense regulations protecting clean air, clean water, and a livable climate future. They say the decision will enable judges to substitute their own interpretation of ambiguous statutory text for those of agency experts when considering agency authority under key environmental, public health, and consumer protection laws. Food and Water Watch says this will make it easier for polluters to challenge regulations in friendly courts and could have a chilling effect on agencies tasked with carrying out these laws. Aaron Duran is a senior staff attorney with Food and Water Watch, an organization that fights for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate for all. Hi, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Though the cases that made their way to the Supreme Court revolve around technical questions about fishing regulations and fees, the Revolving Door Project found that conservative groups with links to the court's billionaire benefactors have directly backed the petitioners in both cases as a means to launch a broader assault on Chevron. A Revolving Door Project analysis found that at least 21 right-wing groups who filed briefs in the Chevron cases have ties to corporate court whisperers like Charles Koch, Leonard Leo, and Paul Singer. These include leading conservative think tanks and litigation groups like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Manhattan Institute, and New Civil Liberties Alliance. Vishal Shankar is senior researcher with the Revolving Door Project, an organization that scrutinizes executive branch appointees to ensure they use their office to serve the broader public interest rather than to entrench corporate power or seek personal advancement. Hi, Vishal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be on, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have all of you. Let's first talk about the importance of the Chevron doctrine. According to many sources, Chevron has been cited more than 19,000 times, making it the third most cited civil case ever. And since Chevron was decided 40 years ago, thousands of legal decisions have relied on the doctrine when challenges have been made to regulate laws like the 1938 Fair Labor Standard, the 1970 Clean Air Act, the 2010 Affordable Care Act. I mean, the list is just so long. So, Amit, let's start off with you. Can you just talk about the importance of the Chevron doctrine?
Sure. So some of the statistics you cited, I think, are kind of self-explanatory and make the case for it being important. I would call the Chevron doctrine, which obviously was overruled now by the Supreme Court, the most important legal doctrine precedent that very few have heard of or no one has heard of, because it certainly has been instrumental in allowing our government to, as you said, do the job that Congress gave it in putting out regulations that that protect the public in all sorts of ways, protect consumers, workers, the environment, minorities, vulnerable populations, food safety, financial reform, certainly in the wake of the financial crash in 2010. All of those instances that where you said the case has been cited, you know, relate to regulations that in one way or another benefit the public, but of course are often opposed by the corporations that that have to comply with the regulations. So, you know, given how under the radar, I think, to the general public, the Chevron doctrine has been, it's had, you know, a disproportionate and outsized impact nonetheless in protecting the public broadly and giving agencies the solid legal basis and certainty to be able to do their job in fashioning regulations in the most effective way possible in terms of protecting the public.
Aaron, what would you like to add?
Sure. Well, I agree with that analysis. And I think as an attorney, I'm part of a community of folks who are more familiar with the Chevron doctrine. And it is a pretty groundbreaking shift in administrative law for the court to come in decades later and overrule this this case, which has had such an outsized influence on the functioning of agencies and the ability of agencies to accomplish what Congress asked them to accomplish through the legislation that the agencies are charged with implementing. So it is a very significant decision and one that will have significant impacts, not only to agencies moving forward, who may now feel a chilling effect, you know, as to what they're legally allowed to do under statutes, but also looking backward. This opens the door to regulations, you know, that have been on the books, and especially when combined with some of the other Supreme Court precedent as of late, I'm thinking of the Corner Post decision, really could potentially open the floodgates to challenges, again, from big moneyed, from big power interests, looking to overturn regulations that have long been established and have long benefited from the Chevron doctrine.
We have a link to an article from CNBC about the Republicans and the big businesses that are praising this decision. Vishal, at the Revolving Door Project, you all did a really important service by following the money. I think that this often is left out. I mean, the Chevron doctrine has gotten so much media attention. We've read dozens of articles, and not one of them mentions what you mention in this report about the 21 right-wing groups linked to what you're calling court whisperers who want the Supreme Court to make its most dangerous regulatory power grab yet. So can you tell us, first of all, this has been a decades-long wish list for big business and Republicans to overturn the Chevron doctrine. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And one interesting tidbit here is that when Chevron was originally issued in the 80s, a lot of people might not know this, it was actually welcomed by the right-wing movement and big business for a very simple fact that the courts at the time were certainly more liberal than they are today, but fairly liberal. And the executive branch at the time, remember, this is the height of the Reagan Revolution, was controlled by business-friendly Republicans. But over time, as Democrats have regained their electoral competitiveness in presidential elections, we've had two terms under Clinton, two under Obama, one so far under Biden, and have sort of rolled back that Reagan regulatory rollback, the big business lobby has looked increasingly towards the courts as the venue by which they can achieve deregulation. Recall as well, over the last 40 years, we've had people like Leonard Leo and Mitch McConnell increasingly pack the courts with far-right, highly ideological Federalist Society judges. As for the big money interests that really use the Loper Bright and Relentless cases as stalking horses for a broader repeal of Chevron. You're right. We at the Revolving Door Project did try to put the pieces together and follow the money. For the sake of fairness, I will point out that there has been some excellent reporting in the New York Times and other outlets going after a few particular groups in these cases. One is the Cause of Action Institute, which is really a shell law firm that backed the petitioners in one of these Chevron cases, the Loper-Bright one. If you go to the Cause of Action Institute's website, you will learn very little about this firm or who their lawyers are. But if you dig a bit deeper on the names of the lawyers who are listed on this brief, you will find that they all have day jobs at the Charles Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity, a notorious conservative advocacy group, one of the architects of the Tea Party movement about a decade ago. And Cause of Action's board is stacked with litigators and executives who are linked to Koch Industries, including one lawyer who's currently defending the company in an ongoing lawsuit filed by the Minnesota Attorney General. Similarly, I mean, you mentioned at the top of the show, Rose, the petitioners in the Relentless case were represented by New Civil Liberties Alliance, another right-wing litigation group that has received funding from the Koch Foundation, somewhere in the range of $1 million, and also from Leonard Leo's Dark Money Groups, 85 Fund and Donors Trust. Beyond that, we found about 19 groups with various personal and financial ties to court power brokers who have been embroiled in the Supreme Court ethics scandals. Paul Singer, the Koch, Leonard Leo. And it just speaks to how these groups, and really these billionaire benefactors, are using amicus briefs increasingly as a means of judicial lobbying to have the Supreme Court justices, particularly those who are in their pocket, directly hear the arguments they're making, albeit cloaked behind a layer or two of funneling the money through various organizations or think tanks. So yeah, there's certainly a great element of corruption going on here.
So I think this is important just for background. And given that we have time, it's important to lay this out. So NPR reports that the case that the Supreme Court recently ruled on revolves around an unlikely set of plaintiffs, a group of herring fishermen based in Rhode Island and Cape May, New Jersey. One of them is Bill Bright, a first-generation fisherman whose family has followed him to the sea. He said, "My boys are working on the boats, my daughters, we have a shoreside business, so we're the whole family's in the seafood business, 100%. Bill Bright said he welcomes regulations to keep the herring population strong in the northeastern U.S., but he said fisheries went too far when the government mandated that vessel owners like him had to pay for observers on their boats to make sure that they're following the rules." And so that's Bill Bright. And as you report, herring fisherman Bill Bright is represented by the Cause of Action Institute. This is a shell law firm whose lawyers also work for the Charles Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity. Cause of Action's board is stacked with litigators and executives linked to Koch Industries, including a lawyer who's defending the company in an ongoing climate lawsuit filed by the Minnesota Attorney General. So can you just talk more about why it's so important to follow the money here? Because you're bringing out organizations that most people have never heard of.
Certainly. Well, I think it's important because the story that the petitioners, or rather the groups that are backing them, are trying to tell to the public is vastly different from the real story. If you were to hear the tale from the Cause of Action Institute, they're very much sort of capitalizing on Bill Bright as, and my friend Lisa Graves made this analogy on her podcast very well, I thought, a sort of a judicial equivalent of Joe the Plumber, if listeners recall that character from the 2008 election, telling this sort of David versus Goliath tale of the ordinary American Joe who is being weighed down by these oppressive Big Brother government regulations. In fact, the opposite is true. If you follow the money, really these cases, I mean, like I mentioned before, are being used as stalking horses to advance a colossal corporate power grab on the behalf of power brokers like the Kochs, like Harlan Crowe, Leonard Leo, Paul Singer. The Goliath here is not the government. It is unchecked corporate power.
And to
add to that, I mean, I think, you know, if there's one takeaway your listeners have from this conversation, it's that the outcome here in overruling, in the Supreme Court overruling Chevron, is clearly that corporations, the biggest corporations in the country are the biggest winners in this case. And the losers are going to be, unfortunately, everyday Americans that, you know, whether they're aware of it or not, rely on the government to issue regulations that they benefit directly from, even if they don't necessarily see it, you know, all the time in their everyday lives. And, you know, certainly this was a cynical strategy to try to put a sympathetic party, you know, as Vishal was talking about, before the court, to try to make it seem like, you know, this was going to help the little guy. But we at Public Citizen, we also did a study looking at the amicus briefs, the same ones that Revolving Door Project looked at, just to look at, you know, where the corporations that filed amicus briefs, where they came down in terms of their position on Chevron. And every one of the briefs that were filed by corporations or trade groups representing those corporations pushed the court to overturn Chevron. So there's no nuance about this. The corporate special interests wanted the court to overturn Chevron because they know that they would be the ones that would be, you know, that would benefit the most from the decision.
The AP has a piece about amicus briefs, and they say with billions of dollars potentially at stake, groups representing the gun industry and other businesses such as tobacco, agriculture, timber, and home building were among those pressing the justices to overturn the Chevron doctrine and weaken government regulations. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce also filed an amicus brief last year on behalf of business groups. Today on Your Call, we are beginning a series on recent Supreme Court rulings. Today, we're talking about what the Chevron ruling means for everyday life. The six conservatives on the Supreme Court have drastically weakened the power of federal regulators at agencies like the EPA and the FTC by overturning the 40-year-old Chevron doctrine. If you have any questions or comments about the Chevron doctrine and what this now means for so many aspects of our everyday lives, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Amit Narang, regulatory consultant with Public Citizen, Vishal Shankar, senior researcher with the Revolving Door Project, and Aaron Durin, a senior staff attorney with Food and Water Watch. Aaron, you're an attorney. Let's talk about what this actually means. And I just want to read a few quotes from people who have sounded off on this. First off, David Doniger, is that how you say his last name? I'm not sure. Do you know? David
Doniger. I think it's Doniger. Yeah.
Okay, Doniger. A lawyer and longtime Natural Resources Defense Council official who argued the original Chevron case in 1984 told the AP that he feared that a ruling to overturn the doctrine could, quote, free judges to be radical activists who could effectively rewrite our laws and block the protections they are supposed to provide. He said the net effect will be to weaken our government's ability to meet the real problems the world is throwing at us, big things like COVID and climate change. So can you talk more about just how this is going to play out in everyday life?
Sure. To start, just to give a little bit more form to the Chevron doctrine, when it comes into play is when agencies are implementing statutes that they've been charged to implement by Congress. And what happens when an agency interpretation is challenged in a court is that judges under the Chevron doctrine would typically look to the statutory language first and use all the tools that judges have available to do that with regard to statutory interpretation to try to figure out if Congress spoke directly to an issue. If Congress didn't, if the statute is silent or ambiguous, that's when a court would defer to an agency interpretation as long as that interpretation is permissible or reasonable. So in terms of the power shift that's happening here with overruling Chevron, instead of a court deferring to an agency in that second part of the Chevron test, the court is free to interpret the statute and interpret the ambiguity or the silence as the court sees fit. So that power is being taken away from agencies who have, you know, folks there with subject matter expertise, with expertise on how different regulatory programs work, who are charged with making policy decisions, who have some accountability through the executive branch. And it's going to the courts. And if we go back to kind of the big corporate interests and the big moneyed interests, what they'll be able to do without Chevron is forum shop or look for a court that's friendly to business. Mm. And that court, in the absence of Chevron, will be able to interpret a statute that is silent or ambiguous in the way the court sees fit. So that's where the power is shifting here. It's a power grab by the courts at the expense of agencies and also at the expense of Congress, who had delegated to agencies the ability to implement through regulations the legislation that they've passed. So that's the shift that's happening here with Chevron, and that's how it will play out. We'll see decisions from courts, and especially courts and forums that are industry-friendly, that are unfavorable to regulation, that you know, further diminish the administrative state and hinder the agency's ability to effectuate the legislation that they're charged with implementing.
So this is a major, major shift in power.
Yes, it is. So it again is the court kind of taking that power from the agency and saying it is not, you know, binding on the court to listen to agency experts, to listen to agencies, you know, interpretations in these policy decisions. It is the court who will step in and will make that determination in the case of statutory silence or ambiguity. And again, if you're looking at folks who are interested in challenging regulations and their ability to look for courts that are friendly to that, what we can expect to see is a pretty significant shift in, you know, what would have been regulations being upheld. I thought an interesting point in the Loper-Bright case in the dissent was that Chevron actually resulted in judicial consistency and agreement and less partisanship. So without Chevron, you know, we could see the opposite of that, with inconsistency among the courts and more partisanship coming to the forefront in these cases where courts are taking that interpretive step instead of deferring to agencies.
And again, to bring this back to everyday life, Lisa Heinzingler, an expert in administrative law at Georgetown University, told the New York Times, quote, "If Americans are worried about their drinking water, their health, their retirement account, discrimination on the job, if they fly an airplane, drive a car, if they go outside and breathe air, all of these day-to-day activities are run through a massive universe of federal agency regulations. And this decision now means that more of those regulations could be struck down by the courts." So we're going to take a quick break. And after the break, I'd love to ask all of you, what do you think is going to come first? What regulations do these corporations want struck down? I mean, you cannot imagine that they're, well, you think about Boeing. I was going to say, you can't imagine that they'd want to loosen rules that are in place when it comes to flying planes. But then you look at all of the corners. I mean, we've done shows about Boeing with whistleblowers about what they've done at their company. And so you just wonder, what are they going after first? How far are they willing to go? On today's Your Call, we are talking about the six conservatives on the Supreme Court who've drastically weakened the power of federal regulators at agencies like the EPA and the FTC by overturning the 40-year-old Chevron doctrine. How is this going to play out in the months and years to come? Aaron Doran is senior staff attorney with Food and Water Watch. Amit Narang is regulatory consultant with Public Citizen. And Vishal Shankar is senior researcher with the Revolving Door Project. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will continue our series on Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation's far-right plan for a second Trump administration. We'll talk about how Trump would deconstruct the administrative state, consolidate executive power, eliminate entire agencies like NOAA, and fire over 50,000 civil servants and replace them with MAGA loyalists. How will they pull this off? We started our Project 2025 series last week, and then about a year ago, we focused specifically on what it would do to dismantle climate policies. You can find those shows at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are beginning a series about Supreme Court rulings, and today we're talking about what the Chevron ruling means for everyday life. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Vishal Shankar, Senior Researcher with the Revolving Door Project, Aaron Doran, Senior Staff Attorney with Food and Water Watch, and Amit Narang, Regulatory Consultant with Public Citizen. We talked about how judges are now going to have so much more power because of this. And I wonder what your thoughts are about something that the National Resources Defense Project wrote. They wrote that an obvious problem with giving judges this unrestrained interpretive authority, the federal court system is huge, and the roughly 850 judges who sit on the lower courts are philosophically and ideologically diverse, to say the least. And as the judicial appointments process has become increasingly partisan, the range of these judges' views has gotten even wider. Ending Chevron deference is tantamount to throwing a dart at a lower court dartboard and hoping for the best. And John Walkey, a senior advocate at NRDC, said that there are more than 10 different circuits, each with multiple judges, each with the ability to decide which reasonable interpretation is their preferred reasonable interpretation. That is probably not the result that those who called for an end to Chevron deference had in mind, but it's what we're all dealing with now. So, Aaron, what about that? I mean, you made the point that what they're going to do is look for a friendly court, but is that always possible?
So it is possible some of the time. Where it's not possible is where you have a statute that dictates where a lawsuit has to be brought. But I think, the point about the variety among the lower courts is well taken. And that goes back to what I was referring to before from the dissent in Loper Bright, where Justice Kagan makes the point that because courts had to defer to agencies in these circumstances where there was ambiguity or silence, there was actually more consensus among the lower courts. And because that's no longer there, you do have the variety in the lower courts, and you do, unfortunately, in the judiciary, have a significant amount of partisanship and a significant variation between the different courts where industry kind of corporate interests can seek out where they would like to bring some of these challenges. And the result would be, as you suggested, a judge interpreting the statute as that judge sees fit. There's also a lot of interesting language in Chevron, or in the Loper Bright decision overturning Chevron, about how there's variation among judges. There's, a point in the majority opinion about how judges can't agree where there's ambiguity. And there are essentially recognitions that judges don't interpret statutes the same way. So without Chevron as that guidepost, we will see, competing and differing opinions. And unfortunately, where industry has the choice, decisions that will very much fall along the lines of deregulation.
Amit, what would you like to add on this?
Sure. Thanks. I totally agree with what Aaron said. I think one way to look at it is a little bit of a ironic point of view. So, conservatives have long criticized so-called judicial activism in the past, judges overstepping their role. I think one of the main virtues of the Chevron deference doctrine was to limit judicial activism. Essentially, no matter what the judge's policy views were, political views, partisan views were, no matter whether the judge was appointed by a Republican president or a Democratic president, Chevron put, you know, this responsibility on the judge to not substitute their own policy preferences in the place of agency experts, but rather defer to the agency experts because Congress had given the authority to fill any gaps, as Aaron was talking about, any areas in a law that Congress passed where they didn't fill in the details because they in Congress don't have the same expertise as the government experts do and the civil servants do. They gave that authority to the to the agency experts, and now it's obviously been taken away and essentially been given to judges. And so the outcome will be a lot more judicial activism in striking down regulations, you know, across the board that protect the public. And this is, you know, part of the overall conservative legal strategy, which is also certainly very pro-corporate, as I was talking about earlier. Vishal mentioned another irony, which is that the original Chevron case was actually about what was actually essentially a response to the judiciary at the time being more dominated by liberals than conservatives. And so there was an interest in limiting the ability of those liberal justices to strike down regulatory rollbacks from the Reagan administration. Now, clearly, the conservative movement has seen that they own the judiciary much more than the liberals do. And they want to be able to now take down the Chevron deference doctrine in order to allow for these judges to be much, much more activists and use their, you know, partisan policy views against regulation to strike down any regulations that are challenged in their courts.
Vishal, what are your thoughts on this? Given what Aaron said about trying to find a friendly court, but then the NRDC said you might be throwing a dart at a lower court dartboard. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I definitely echo what Aaron and Amit were mentioning. Just to add one little bit to the idea of putting non-expert judges in control of everything as opposed to career civil servants and why that's bad. Just look at SCOTUS itself. The day before the Chevron ruling, they issued a ruling in a case, Ohio versus EPA. The opinion was authored by Neil Gorsuch. And that day, they had to issue a corrected version of that ruling because on five separate occasions in the initial opinion, Justice Gorsuch confused the air pollutant in the case, nitrogen oxide, with the anesthetic nitrous oxide. More popularly known as laughing gas, which is, you know, quite humorous in and of itself, but for the greater stakes of the regulatory state is certainly no laughing matter. But to the broader point of judge shop, this is certainly a phenomenon we've seen increasingly utilized by big business and the right-wing legal movement. Take a look this past term with the Mifepristone case, which ultimately was unsuccessful at the Supreme Court this term. But the court has left the door open for the Idaho Attorney General to continue an assault on Mifepristone later. The case that made it up to the court this term was wholly concocted by a variety of anti-abortion groups backed by Leonard Leo and other power brokers who specifically formed an AstroTurf group to bring this case to the court and incorporated it in a jurisdiction where they knew they would be able to get the case to a very friendly judge, Matthew Kaczmarek, who, before even joining the judiciary, had a history of anti-abortion activism himself. And you're seeing this on corporate regulations as well, with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce attacks on the CFPB's crackdown on predatory junk fees with regards to credit cards and excessive overdraft fees. So I know there's certainly been some guidance from the regulatory authorities about cracking down on these practices of judge shopping and venue shopping. But I fear that it is certainly going to continue to be a tactic employed by a lot of these litigation.
You brought up a few points there. Just to elaborate on what you said about abortion medication, New York Times reporter Elizabeth Diaz reports that anti-abortion activists are celebrating the Chevron ruling as a big win for their plans to further restrict medication abortion. Christy Hamrick, strategist with Students for Life, said getting rid of Chevron is the first domino to fall. They see the decision as a new precedent that can work in their favor as they seek to bring in another case against the FDA to the Supreme Court. Now, you made another good point about judges, and it made me think about how fast Trump appointed judges. We know that so many of these judges came from a list from the Federalist Society. I'm reading a piece from Pew Research, January 2021. Donald Trump leaves the White House having appointed more than 200 judges to the federal bench, including nearly as many powerful federal appeals court judges in 4 years as Barack Obama appointed in 8. And then I was thinking about what we learned about the qualifications of these judges. The Leadership for Conference on Civil and Human Rights says Trump and Senate Republicans like to claim that the president has chosen highly qualified nominees. The reality is many of Trump's nominees have lacked the basic experience and temperament that should be required to be a federal judge. They have a number of examples, but they cite the American Bar Association. It's a nonpartisan group who said that Trump has nominated the highest number of individuals who are not qualified because of their lack of relevant legal and judicial experience. 9 of Trump's picks received this non-qualified rating, a record indeed, but not the kind anyone should want to boast about. So, Aaron, if we're talking about public safety, environmental laws, retirement accounts, abortion medication, I mean, the list is so long. What happens if one of these highly unqualified judges, someone who knows nothing about science or healthcare, you name it, is able to rule on these cases?
Well, I think that is the concern that many of us have at the moment. With a judge, you know, like that in a position to look at a statute and say, you know, there's a gap here and I can fill it, you know, creates this environment where instead of valuing what the agency has done, the experts it has on staff, its knowledge, you know, really intricate knowledge of how regulations work together in that field. And instead you have someone who may not understand the subject matter to that degree, you know, coming to what they find is the best interpretation of a statute, you know, unmoored by what the agency's interpretation is. I think that is certainly the concern, you know, following this decision. I think that there's, you know, also, you know, looking at the judiciary, you know, how the court tries to rationalize, the majority rationalizes its, you know, decision to overturn Chevron is by saying that judges are experts in statutory interpretation. But if we're looking, you know, potentially at qualifications and calling those into question, I think we would also have to look at, you know, how judges apply those rules of statutory interpretation, which again, can vary from judge to judge. So it's not only the subject matter expertise of the particular issue at hand, but the legal reasoning that the court, you know, however qualified judges may be, uses to get to its result.
Aaron Doran is senior staff attorney with Food and Water Watch. We're also joined by Amit Narang, regulatory consultant with Public Citizen, and Vishal Shankar, senior researcher with the Revolving Door Project. On today's Your Call, we are talking about what the Chevron ruling means for everyday life. The Chevron doctrine stems from a unanimous Supreme Court case involving the oil giant Chevron in a dispute over the Clean Air Act. This was 40 years ago. It ensured that federal agency experts, not judges, made policy decisions. Public Citizen says this law respects the separation of powers, and they're concerned that this will make it harder for federal agencies to carry out their mandated missions to protect the public. We've got a number of calls and emails, so let's start with a few callers. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, I'm sorry, my radio feedback. Anyway, you shouldn't be referring to these people as conservatives. They're extremists. They'll go as far as they think they can go. And the question is, who's going to stop them? You know, the decisions they're going to be rendering in the future are going to be just as extreme as that immunity decision that they made, the Chevron case. And so who knows? I mean, I don't know what the limit is. And like I said, who's going to stop them? Given Congress and the possibility that Trump could get reelected, you know, I think people will be startled, to say the least, about the decisions. By the way, with regard to experience, all you got to do is look at Eileen Carroll, that judge in Florida who's held up the case of Jack Smith with regard to Trump. They've just scuttled all this, the judges, and he's going to skate. So I think the future is pretty darn dark.
Well, to your point, Greg, Ellie Mastal, justice correspondent with The Nation, who's been on the show, wrote a piece called "It's Impossible to Overstate the Damage Done by the Supreme Court in This Term. The effects of the rulings will be enduring and almost impossible to overturn without a serious reckoning by Democratic lawmakers." Ellie Mastal is very critical of Democrats for refusing to add more justices to the court. He ended the piece by saying the Supreme Court justices will take the summer off to let politicians act like they're important and the voters feel like they're making a difference. But they'll be back this time next year, and they'll continue to do all the things Republicans want that nobody elected them to do. So why don't you take that one first, Vishal? You know, people like Ellie Mastal and so many others say it's time for Democrats to add more justices to the court. That's the only way that you can deal with this. Because you can introduce legislation, which Congresswoman Jayapal has introduced, to take on this Chevron decision. But how is that going to pass, you know, without 60 Democratic senators? So what are your thoughts about what needs to happen to deal with this?
Certainly. I mean, you're absolutely right, Rose. I mean, that is the first major hurdle is with any of these major court reforms, be it court expansion, passing a real binding ethics code for the Supreme Court through Congress, even legislatively codifying things like Roe or Chevron, is the balance of power within Congress itself. I'll just backtrack a little bit and say that I absolutely agree with our caller as well in terms of this court not being, as a lot of pundits I've seen in the media try to spin it, moderate in the slightest. And nor is John Roberts himself. Remember, he's the one who wrote the decision in this case. And the Roberts Court is the court that gave us Citizens United, Janus v. AFSCME, D.C. versus Heller, Shelby County versus Holder, the Dobbs decision, and of course, just this past term, the Trump immunity decision. This is a court that has absolutely no regard for precedent or for the rule of law, only for far-reaching right-wing power grabs on behalf of the Federalist Society and big business. So I think it is incumbent on court reform advocates, on members of Congress, on any other sort of crucial stakeholders to be constantly making this case in speeches in Congress, on the campaign trail, what have you, that this is a fundamentally corrupt and captured court. And not only did the justices embroiled in the worst of these ethics scandals need to be impeached, but we need to be looking forward towards expanding and rebalancing the court.
Amit, what would you add?
So I do think that what's really essential here is that Congress view this as a wake-up call and reacts. You know, we do call it what we view to be a violation of separation of powers because the judiciary is essentially usurping, stealing away power that is essentially the authority Congress has given the government through, you know, the some of the most bedrock public protection laws that has passed, such as the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. We've talked about some of this, some of these laws, worker safety laws, consumer protection laws, financial reform laws. And so, you know, if the Supreme Court is going to violate the separation of powers by giving essentially the judiciary too much power, Congress has to act to take it back. One way, as you profiled, which Public Citizen strongly supports, is the Stop Corporate Capture Act by Representative Jayapal, which would essentially make Chevron deference the law of the land again, and would essentially moot the Supreme Court ruling. As you say, obviously, it's going to be hard to attract the kind of bipartisan support that's necessary for that to actually become the law. But that should not stop those in Congress that are concerned about the you know, how this is going to harm the public and prevent agencies from doing the job Congress gave them to protect the public, should not stop them from pushing aggressively in trying to get the you know, laws like the Stop Corporate Capture, I should say the bills like the Stop Corporate Capture Act passed. And so we hope that over time, some of these efforts can pay off, potentially as the public starts actually seeing the real world impacts of agencies not being able to put out new clean water protections, clean air protections, consumer protections, worker protections, anti-discrimination regulations, you know, regulations on Wall Street, you name it, food safety regulations, even things like trying to prevent all these train explosions that we're seeing in communities' backyards, or forever chemicals that are poisoning the water across communities in the country. So potentially over time, you know, all these harmful impacts will result in a path forward in Congress to make Chevron deference the law of the land again.
Well, thank you for the call, Greg. We're almost out of time, but let's take another caller, Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Hello, thank you for having me. I think one of the key actions that took place that no one's really pointing out is the Trump campaign is now saying, well, we didn't know that, and we had this great administration and these wonderful things, and they're not pointing out that Trump tried to destroy those same alphabet safety departments that we were talking about by appointing heads, consolidating those agencies, and then appointing heads that would destroy it from within. The problem that he ran into, which is also why they're emphasizing on the courses, for example, the NLRB. Remember when he tried to consolidate all the 50 offices into regions and then put heads, administrative heads, over those regions so it was easier to control, and the NLRB directors revolted and said, then we're all quit. So he panicked, and not wanting to have that appear, they backed off from that context, although they were still working to destroy it. So they now came to the conclusion, okay, so if we can capture the courts, which McConnell would convince them, it doesn't matter because the courts can overturn any type of legal.
Well, Brad, thank
foundation.
You for your comment, and we're almost out of time. Sorry to cut you off. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow on our Project 2025 show. Aaron, I wanted to end with you. There are a few articles out there about how lawsuits are already being filed because of the Chevron decision. What do you expect we will see in the coming months? I mean, how far are corporations, these organizations, how far are they willing to go?
Well, that's a great question. And unfortunately, we will see that over the next, you know, weeks and months and years. I think one thing that's important to note is that regulations are already being challenged. The Trump administration, as we all are likely aware, you know, did really attempt to roll back regulations in a way that, you know, a few years later resulted in agencies promulgating rules to try to restore the regulations that would protect the public, that would protect the environment, and those restored regulations are subject to challenge immediately. So regulations are already being challenged, and we'll see Chevron or the lack thereof come up in those cases. I think one other important thing to note, while this opens the door certainly to challenges to current regulations and future regulations, as I mentioned early on in the hour, there was another Supreme Court decision that came out the last day of the term, Corner Post, that eliminated the statute of limitations on challenges under the Administrative Procedure Act, which is at the crux of a lot of these regulatory challenges, which opens the floodgates further. So I think we can expect to see not only current regulations being challenged, the look of those challenges being a little different post-Chevron, but also challenges to long-established, entrenched regulations that people rely upon to keep their air, their water safe, and to keep them healthy.
We have time for one more email. A listener says the Democrats are just getting crushed on these issues. What explains this? Vishal, do you want to take that one quickly? We've got about 30 seconds left.
Certainly. And it's something we've emphasized at the Revolving Door Project is not only should Democrats be running against this corrupt, captured Supreme Court, they should be running against unchecked corporate power. We have an initiative at the Revolving Door Project looking at the corporate crackdown that the Biden administration could be pursuing to go after corporate lawbreakers and unchecked corporate power in a variety of areas. A lot of agencies have taken the lead on this, including the FTC, the CFPB, the Department of Justice Antitrust Division. But I think this is a winning message. This is something that the Democrats can focus on. And certainly if we can get corporate money out of politics and get both parties to stop drinking out of the same trough of corporate money, that would go a long way towards doing that.
Vishal Shankar is senior researcher with the Revolving Door Project. They scrutinize executive branch appointees to ensure they use their office to serve the broad public interest. Aaron Duran is senior staff attorney with Food and Water Watch. They fight for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate for all. Amit Narang is regulatory consultant for Public Citizen, a consumer advocacy organization that champions the public interest in the halls of power. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us.